You're watching Deprogrammed. This is the New Culture Forum show committed to fighting back against the forces of ideological conformity, particularly among the young. My name is Harrison Pitt. I'm a senior editor at the European Conservative, and I'm thrilled to be joined today, stepping in for Evan again this week, by Amy Gallagher, who you will no doubt recognize from Newspeak and from some of her other shows. She's also done a Heresies documentary, as you will know, and she's also currently in the process of suing the NHS for all manner of iniquities. And our special guest this week, Charlie Sansom, a political commentator, DJ, singer, and citizen journalist, and crucially as well, Charlie was in fact present at the recent St. George's Day scuffle between the Met Police and predominantly white working class Englishmen celebrating their patron saint. Now, the white working classes are not a very popular interest group in this country. What did you see on St. George's Day in Whitehall, and have these chaps been underserved by the coverage?
Well, what I saw was the police being a bit heavy-handed. So the famous clip that's gone around in the last week or so of the horses charging in and the police vans and everything else, it was a flash of the pan. You know, that lasted for about 30 seconds. And then it was over. But of course, the media, the journalists on the ground got their clip, which is what they were really there for, to kind of make the right wing look bad. And they got it, and that's what it was. But I was on the other side of the room when that happened, and I couldn't work out why the police had moved in, because people were just walking down the road with England flags and they weren't doing anything. No one went there for trouble, I can guarantee that.
Yeah, but you were there, and what did you see? Like, what was most of the evening like? Because they were there for 2 hours or so, right? Isn't that correct? Or something like that? What was most of the occasion like, someone who was there?
Do you know what? It was actually rather celebratory. Yeah. People were happy, they were jubilant. Yeah. I think they were happier still because Tommy Robinson got a fair ruling in a court for once. And that was what they were there for. They wanted to celebrate. You know, one of the things that I find frustrating about the media is that they go hammer and tong saying that it's far right. I don't understand what's far right about men, women and children of all colours coming together to stand in front of a stage and listen to patriotic speeches.
Amy?
Yeah, I'm just thinking, I think is that, I mean, they're pro-free speech, aren't they? And they're pro-patriotism. I think the kind of optics of it is that maybe like in the 70s or 80s, when you had like the English Defence League or the British National Party that may have waved the English flag, it was associated with racism. But I think now we've moved on so far in terms of the threats to free speech and concerns about immigration, that they're so, and they're so much more mild, this group now that are waving the England flag, that it doesn't resemble those groups, to my mind, it doesn't resemble those groups very much at all now. But there's still that idea in people's minds that it's somehow a kind of a racist movement, which it seems to be not at all. It's more of a reaction to concerns that most of us have. I don't know what you think of that.
I agree with you. I don't think that people there were racist. I mean, I went there looking to take in the day. I don't really go to marches or anything like that. I've never really been that interested. But when I went there, I was actually rather surprised, because if you just read the headlines in from Sky or The Guardian or whichever rag you want to read, that was a compliment really for them. But you know, you think that everyone there was a racist and they're looking for a fight and they're drunk and they're out of control. That wasn't the case. You know, you saw women there, you saw children there, you saw disabled people there, you saw black people there, brown people there, white people there. I don't see how you could... Where's the racism coming from if you've got all those people there? Where's the bigotry exactly?
It's true. I also assume but when you said in the 70s and 80s, you meant the National Front rather than the English Defence.
Sorry, that's what I meant, sorry.
We should correct the record there just a tiny bit. But yeah, that is a concern, but then I also think that, so I understand why people on the right tend to say this a bit, but I actually don't think the flag was ever really, you know, there, but belonged to those people anyway. I think that is predominant. This is actually quite a left-wing narrative, which some people on the right have bought into, the idea that the flag was, the status of the flag and what it meant was somehow in jeopardy until the 90s when Cool Britannia came in and we sort of reclaimed this. Never since then, it doesn't need to be demonized. A posh spice with the Union Jack, it became cool again to be British.
She was always my favourite.
Yeah, was she really? We can get into that later in the programme, Charlie. Maybe a special afterlife. I'm interested about anything. But so I don't think that was ever too much of a problem. The problem seemed to me is the fact that the police, you talk about the you know, rags there, like Sky News and the BBC, but the police, what I found particularly shocking in this case is that they actually preempted what was going to happen. Mm. If I'm not mistaken, they actually put out a tweet in advance saying that there are going to be quote-unquote far-right elements present at this protest. Where on earth did they get that from?
I've got no idea. I think that the connection between Tommy Robinson and the Day might have given them that assumption to make. But I didn't see it. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to go to West Ham a lot when I was younger. You know, you saw some people pretend to be double tasty at the football matches. But
what does double tasty mean?
Double tasty. You know, they want to give it the big in a little bit. They think they think they're a bit hard, you know.
Oh, okay.
Want to be Ray Winston's.
I see, yeah.
So, you know, I didn't see that. I just didn't see it. And I think that they preempt these kind of things so it gives them the pretext to be a bit heavy-handed, which was unnecessary. I believe, truly, that if the police weren't there, there would have been no trouble.
Yes.
Because no one was there looking for trouble amongst different communities or different races or colours or whatever you want to call it. But the moment the police started blocking roads and charging people with horses, I mean, I saw one video where a young girl was screaming because she was scared of the horses coming towards them. And I thought, all they're doing is walking down the road.
Mm.
Why are you preventing people from walking down the road? But, you know, it happened and, you know, you can see it, but there's a video on my ex, my Twitter, where you can see the other side of the road, which, you know, you can make your own minds up. Was it violent or was it not? But I don't think so.
Yeah, and they were... Go on.
Oh, no, I was just saying, it's interesting, because in the tweet that you're referring to, I think the police put something like the far right and football fan. And
it's like, why?
I mean, there's two totally different categories.
Yeah.
And it's like, we're just going to lump... They just mean working class, don't they? They're just lumping...
Basically, yeah.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah,
they're lumping all that in. And it's like, what do you mean by far right? Like, what sentiment are they expressing that's far right? Because I could look at the pro-Palestinian marches and say, well, there's people denying the Holocaust. There's people saying that Hitler got it right. You could say that's far right, but like, what is this group, this kind of English St. George's Day protest? What are they saying that's far right? I don't know.
Well, I didn't hear a word of anything far right. Nothing racist. I mean, I'll keep saying that. I honestly didn't hear anything. And I would tell you, you know, this is the first time I went to a march or a celebration of this nature, and I didn't see anything bad.
Yes.
There was, I'll tell a lie. There was one thing that did go wrong.
But this was after...
This was after the famous video.
You've spoken to me about this privately. You tell our viewers now.
And later on during the day, a gentleman got arrested. I don't know why, but he walked past another pub where people are looking at the police arresting somebody, going, oh, they're out to get us. Look, they're nicking us, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So some idiot threw a pint of beer at the police. And that's when they shut the pubs down.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people were complaining, saying, oh, look, they're just trying to ruin our fun. They're out to get us. The police don't like us.
Mm-hmm.
And objectively, if you are going to throw things at the police, you're going to have to expect them to react to that. Because if one does it, two will do it, three will do it, four will do it, and then it becomes a riot, which is what you don't want. Mm-hmm. And it actually detracts from the point of the day.
Completely. And this is we'll get into this a little bit more later about it. I mean, quite apart from what we at Three People think of the goodness of these people, the fundamental goodness of these people, and their fundamentally correct instincts about the state of the country, and their completely healthy and natural desire to want to celebrate its identity on St. George's Day, we'll get into whether it's whether there might be wiser strategic ways of navigating these events, because it seems to me that it's my take on the day, and I don't know if you two agree, is that the police, by issuing that statement about far-right elements and God forbid football fans being present on St. George's Day, by issuing that in advance, they really gave the game away, because they didn't really supply any evidence for that being the case, and you said you certainly didn't see any evidence there. And it was only once they'd cordoned these people, who, let's be honest, had probably had 3 or 4 or 5 drinks, cordoned them into a tight space where they feel put upon in their capital city, when all they want to do, they don't want to climb on monuments and drape them in foreign flags. They want to, you know, on like parade through Whitehall, probably go towards Trafalgar Square, which would make sense, to celebrate St. George's Day in the way that has been. There's a beautiful picture in 1905 of Trafalgar Square on 100 years on from the Battle of Trafalgar, and there are no police there, because there didn't need to be any police there, because it wouldn't have been assumed in 1905 that there's anything remotely offensive or wrong about celebrating English, in this case British, in the case of Trafalgar, British identity in the heart of and capital of Britain. It's a completely normal thing to want to do. But by the police, by cordoning them in and making it less difficult for these chaps, who probably had quite a few drinks, to enjoy themselves, what you get is an understanding an understandable irritability setting in among the crowd. And it's at that moment that you start getting people throwing beer at horses or people doing whatever, like breaking police barricades. And then the media have the headline they want. The police are vindicated for calling these people far right in advance. That seems to me to be what happened on that day. Have I got anything wrong there?
No, I mean, I don't know how drunk people were.
Okay.
I would say that is by and large spot on.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't see why the police did it. They didn't need to do it. And some people on Twitter are talking about, well, they left the designated area.
Yeah.
But the speeches were being made in Whitehall. There was one road, you know, where else are they supposed to go on a straight road?
Yes.
So the logic there is gone. But, you know, I try to find the best in the police because I think if I was in trouble, I'd like to rely on them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they do let themselves down quite a lot. They're too political. The police are far too political. They need to just step away, stop following directives from the Mayor of London, I would assume. To say that very carefully, I would assume they take directives from the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan.
Yeah.
But they shouldn't. They should just police with fairness. You know, if they see someone doing something wrong, they should just deal with that person, not just paint people with the same brush.
And I suspect part of the reason for these protests or gatherings, whatever you want to call them, is because people are annoyed at just that, that they're seeing that there is already two-tier policing. They're seeing that the pro-Palestinian marches or the Black Lives Matter marches aren't being policed fairly, and they want to come out and represent their beliefs. Mm-hmm. And then, on top of that, they see how the police turn on them during those marches. And then, of course, that ignites a kind of irritability and a reaction because that's the thing that they're already irritated at in the first
place. This is the issue. People feel like it's a double standard.
Yeah.
And I've never seen riot gear or police horses at a Palestine march.
Never.
And I didn't really cotton on to that until someone made that point to me. And I was like, do you know what? You're right. They've never brought them out. And I've seen a video of pro-Palestine marchers firing fireworks around Trafalgar Square. And the police are standing there doing nothing. But you can bet your bottom dollar that if St. George's Day people brought fireworks, it would have been game over from the start.
Absolutely. And if they were climbing on public monuments, and if they were draping themselves in, you know, incipiently threatening, like in threatening looking gear, I don't even know what the equivalent would be in this case if they are far right, which is still yet to be defined adequately by the police as a term. It was very funny the other day, a chap in the House of Lords who was ironically called Lord Sharp.
I know where this is going already.
defined far right as anyone who gives credence to far right beliefs, which is the most circular definition you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, what is that?
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So it's just pathetic. So this is a completely nebulous term which is just used to stigmatize people. Clearly, that's what it is at this point. It's just a very you know, blunt club to wield against your enemies. But they weren't, as many of the sort of anti-Israel, anti-Western, pro-Palestine marchers do, draping themselves in the sort of paraphernalia of Hamas, that you see that routinely, having paragliders on their back glorifying what happened on the 7th of October last year. And it seems to me that one of the problems here is that the police don't really think of themselves anymore as neutral enforcers of the law, where you're supposed to enforce the law without fear or favor. They think of themselves more as sort of referees or diplomats between competing community interests, and therefore, like, whichever community interest has better PR or has a better shake. It's not so much that the police are political; it's that they're very sensitive to politics, and they realize that, you know, we're not going to get much flack from the sources that really matter. Yeah, we might get slammed a bit on NCF, we might get slammed a bit on GB News, but we'll basically curry favour with most of the mainstream media if we police this quite harshly, whereas we risk igniting community relations, which are supposed to be our greatest strength, yet they're constantly existing on a knife edge, if we police the Palestinian marches too strongly, because then we risk, you know, triggering minority sentiment.
Do you think that's the real reason, PR? I think it's to prevent riots.
Because
in the case of, if you start arresting Palestine supporters, which will be by and large Muslim, how do you think they're going to react en masse?
Exactly. But do you want to say?
Yeah, I think the police are acting, it's almost like it's just kind of conflict management, where it's not about who's on the right side of the law.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, how best can we manage this and not, as you say, cause a riot?
Yes.
Let me put a question to both of you. Do you think that the management of the Palestine marches would be different if they had more numbers?
Yes.
Potentially, yes.
Well, you mean, sorry, the police have more numbers.
The police.
the police, if the, yeah. sorry, if the police had more numbers,
yes, I think,
do you think they would actually police those marches?
I think a little bit, but I think it's both quantitative and qualitative. So the main point I was leaning into there is the qualitative point. Mm. The simple fact is that if you can drape your grievances in the sort of a minoritarian garb, we are put upon minority, you know, like wrong though this is, sort of white working class codes for privileged majority. And so ideologically, you're not going to get much flack if you come down hard on a protest, or even in this case, just a celebration, which is predominantly consists of white working class chaps. But if they're sort of young Muslims, mm-hmm. or fill in blank here to do with a minority, then all of a sudden you're going to get accusations of systemic racism, particularly since the McPherson report, the police are petrified, far more petrified of that than they're petrified of being accused of two-tier policing by people like us. So it's qualitative, but then of course you throw into the mix small numbers of people who've trained in from other parts of the country. It's much easier to deal with them than it is to deal with like great big hordes of Palestinian pro-Palestine protests, which are you see the police, we've seen these clips, and the Inc. Monocle puts them up on X all the time. You see clips where people are saying, Inc. Monocle will go, I got a copper. Do you not see what they just said? Do you know what that means? That they're glorifying, you know, the Houthis firing rockets at British ships in the Arabian Gulf. And they're like, what can I do about it? What do you want me to do? You know, so I think numbers comes into it as well. But there is also that ideological qualitative strain which runs through.
The irony is, isn't it, that the pro St. George's Day English flag waving gatherings are the actual minority in terms of numbers and in terms of power and, mm-hmm. and status. Yes. And the pro-Palestinians have much more power and much more numbers. So it's a complete reversal of kind of the ideology in a way. And I do wonder if they go so harshly, the police go so harshly on the St. George's Day protests, it's almost like a kind of displacement. It's like, yeah. we couldn't deal with these pro-Palestinian marches for months and months, yeah. but here's something we can do. Yeah. Let's go really hard to look like we're doing something, you know, when we haven't been doing anything for months. It feels like that's happening a little bit.
I would agree with that. I mean, one of the reasons why I think they get away with it is because many people these days have been indoctrinated into thinking that being white is bad and they're guilty for being white. And I don't understand that. And that's drilled into people, and I can see it all over the place where people apologise for things they haven't even done based on the colour of their skin. That's the racism.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's the real racism.
It's much more pervasive, I would say. And one of the things I would accuse the right of as well, and I should make it clear at the outset that I'm in favour of mobilising every possible resource that we have in order to protect synagogues in this country. So I definitely think that the rise in anti-Semitism among, like people always say, the rise of anti-Semitism in Britain, people mean among certain diasporas in Britain, not the British people themselves. It's still, like, among the white majority, there is still a massive taboo, correctly, against any kind of anti-Semitic speech. There's a bit of, you know, shady language going on there. But so I'm in favour of doing that, but I'm in favour of protecting Jewish people, particularly in London, from harm by these sort of ethno-religious zealots. However, I do think that it's notable that it's very acceptable to couch our objection to what's been going on, our objections to multiculturalism, our objections to diversity, in terms which say we're sort of protecting Jewish people. And even though that's is right to do, I would argue that anti-white sentiment has been much more pervasive in Britain for much longer. And not only that, like, you know, look at the mayor of London, if you disagree with me, plastering the tube with anti-white revenge, race revenge porn. You know, your people like Humza Yousaf railing against the existence of whites in majority 96% white Scotland. Mm. So that's much more pervasive than anti-Semitism. And yet on the right, we're so petrified to go near what you just said, saying anti-whiteness is endemic in this country and in our institutions, that we constantly feel like we need to couch it purely in terms of opposing anti-Semitism. And though that must be opposed, there is also the risk there that you actually entrench the left's way of operating, because the left's way of operating is that minorities are sacred and good and majorities are incipiently evil and bad. Mm. And if you're couching your objection to multiculturalism in terms of let's protect this specific minority, namely Jews, even though that's right to do morally, it's not sufficient because you're actually entrenching the left's way of operating.
Mm. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think one thing I say often is that the further you get away from being a straight white male, the more offended and outraged you're allowed to be.
Mm. Yes.
So my opinion, your opinion, it's invalid.
Yes.
Just on virtue of us being white and straight.
Yes. Well, how do you know?
Well,
I'm glad I'm
assuming you're generous. Well, by the way, you know, I don't worry, I insult you at all.
You've nailed it, although you are wearing a pink top, so, you know.
Yeah, I'm suspiciously
well groomed. Well groomed today as well, Charlie.
Well, I made an effort, and this is Sandler, not Pete.
That distinction in itself is majorly suspect. Right. Amy, so I mean, do you fear this problem on the right of just not so much being wrong morally, but framing our moral objections in the wrong way?
I still feel like the majority of people are uncomfortable talking about anti-white racism, like what white people, that it's not taken seriously, that they don't, it's just not seen as a real thing.
Mm-hmm. But you must use your privilege, Amy.
Well, I think what happens is that people with the Jews, like, there is a history there, and the thing that's always the accusation that's made of anyone that says anything that's against the sort of narrative is that you're a Nazi. You know, if you disagree with gender ideology or critical race, you're a Nazi. And of course, the Jews were the victims of the Nazis, so it's much easier to argue for them than it is for anti-white racism. But you know, I agree with you. I think it's just as awful and just as wrong. And if you go back to sort of first principles of, you know, not treating a person differently because of the skin colour of this city, it's exactly the same thing. But we're just very squeamish. Yes. And I mean, I'm involved in a lawsuit against, you know, anti-white sentiment. But I do notice that people are very squeamish about talking about it. I'm noticing more people are now pushing back against so-called anti-racism, which is anti-white. That's what it is. But they won't say that. But they'll say, oh, yeah, I'm against anti-racism. I don't, you know, I think it's harmful, it doesn't bring about cohesion, it's divisive, but there's still, people still won't name it as anti-white racism. And I guess things, and maybe it's because there hasn't been a precedent for it, there hasn't been some kind of historical precedent that people can refer to, but it's it's all the same thing.
I think that's definitely a huge part of it, the lack of an historical precedent, or but many people would want to point to South Africa and Zimbabwe,
of course,
and other places which are, again, is sort of considered taboo even to go anywhere near that. Or you could talk about, you know, Haiti in 1804, basically killing all the whites, but then fortunately after that succeeding massively as a country. So there is that concern there.
But there isn't a narrative, is there, of kind of anti-white racism in history? Although, as you say, there are examples of it in various countries. Mm-hmm. For some reason, it's not something that's taught or established. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's interesting in and of itself, why it isn't.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's true. But I also think that the majority-minority thing comes into play as well. And one of the really difficult things, and I think one of the reasons why the left, particularly in America at the moment, but also here in subtler ways, is really torn on Israel-Palestine, is because it's almost, which minority are we going to side with? Because in America and in Britain, Jewish people and Muslim people are both minorities at the moment. And so you can frame your pro-Palestinian fervor in minoritarian terms, and you can frame your pro-Israeli sentiment in minoritarian terms. And so you've got this horrible, actually quite satisfying to watch in some senses, divide on the left, particularly in the college campuses, of between more elite, older democratic politicians for whom anti-Semitism is a really, really big taboo still, and it still exercises a stronghold. So like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer would be perfect examples of this, and like people like Jonathan Greenblatt at the ADL, all these people who are very pro-Israel and are completely horrified. They're on the left, they were all for BLM, but they're completely horrified by this next iteration of left-wing fervor on campus. So you've got that group, but then you've also got the younger, more sort of ethnically and culturally diverse groups of people. And so you've got these people like AOC and people like Rashida Tlaib, and also sort of students on campus for whom anti-Semitism isn't a very strong taboo, because they don't feel as implicated in the Second World War as Europeans do. That's the first thing. So they don't feel as though sort of, you know, whites have inherited this blood guilt because of what happened in the Holocaust. And they rather resent the fact that Jewish people, who are a very successful minority, have been able to perch at the top of the victim hierarchy since the Second World War, despite in their eyes being oppressors in Israel. So you've got this huge divide going on the left, and it makes for very confusing politics.
So this is a culture problem.
Yes,
the importation of culture.
Yes, I think
the issue there.
I think that is the issue, and I also think as well, I think a lot of there's evidence on this. There's a Cambridge study about this, which talks about anti-Semitism among different groups in the United States in particular. But I would imagine it translates here as well. they're like, and one of the theses that these people put forward for why it is higher among minority groups is that they actually don't think of Jewish people as non-white. So a good example of this would be when, do you remember when Whoopi Goldberg said on The View that the Holocaust wasn't racist because it was just man's inhumanity to man, i.e. the Germans and Jews, they were both white Europeans, and so it's cruel, and obviously she wasn't saying she supported it, but she was saying it's not racism. Jews often in these contexts massively codes white, and this there's another banner at the palace, you're either on the white side of history or the right side of history, and like Israel and America are the white side of history, so you get this really these really confusing games going on.
But I guess Whoopi Goldberg would have said that slavery was racist.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because it's really hard to make an argument that slaves were white.
The fact that white people started the slavery.
Exactly, yes.
You know, that's a convenient omission from history there. Sorry to put it out there for you guys, but that is the truth.
Fortunately, I think our audience is aware of this.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, for those who aren't aware, like, I find it baffling that, you know, the white man is always the guilty party when it comes to slavery.
Yeah.
When there's slavery going on right now, millions of slaves in Africa right now. No one says anything about that, but please give me reparation. Make that make sense.
And I think the Jews are not only just lumped in with kind of whiteness or white people, but they're also seen as kind of Western. I think Israel is seen as the West, and Palestine is seen as the Arab or Middle Eastern world, and that's why they fall on the side of anti-Israel,
exactly,
and anti-Jew.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so the really interesting thing that's been going on, and Curtis Yarvin, in a very, very good piece about Israel and Gaza a couple of months ago, made this point excellently. Like trying to get into the left-wing mind, he wasn't saying that he agrees with this, but he was saying that there's nothing new about this form of decolonization that's going on now, in terms of people talking about let's decolonize Palestine, all that sort of thing. And earlier, obviously, in 2020, it was all about decolonize Britain and or America or whatever. As he said, the Zionist exception is just unraveling. And this is another thing we could get into as well. We're talking about strategy here, and the Republicans, in my view, have been very stupid in that I've just talked about this civil war that's going on the left. And Napoleon says, never interrupt your enemy when he's making a mistake. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the left are going to war with each other. Like, obviously, if people are breaking the law and intimidating Jewish students, send the police in. But a lot of what Republicans' governors have been doing has been like much more heavy than that. It's been sort of, you know, issuing sort of executive orders clamping down on speech and all these sorts of things. And not only is that wrong in principle, in my view, but I also don't think that we should be, as I say, separating these two fighters, that we should be letting them have it out so long as people are not actually fighting, getting by. Law and order need to prevail. So I think the right is addicted to losing in all sorts of ways and doing all sorts of stupid things, usually in the name of sort of nobility. Do you think that there is a failure of strategy, coming back to this St. George's Day scuffle, do you think that there is a failure of strategy among these very well-motivated, decent, working-class men, but do you think in many ways they are falling into elephant traps set by their enemies, and that strategically they'd be much more sensible to adopt a different tact?
Well, yeah, I do agree with the sentiment you've just made there, because I would argue that if you are going to be stopped by the police mid-flow, just stand still.
Yeah.
Don't argue with them. There's no value in that, because they're going to find a way to nick you. Mm. Just stand still. If they want to block the road, just wait. If you don't kick off, they can't actually prevent you from moving. They're going to wait up and see if you're going to be a bit aggy. Mm. And if you're not, what can they do?
Yes.
They'll move you on.
Yes. Mm. How do we solve this, though? Because this never happens, and understandably it doesn't, because I would be enraged if I would. And their instincts are so solid, and I don't want to... Like, it actually makes me feel sick to my stomach when you just see these sort of chinless idiots like Tom Tugendhat saying these people are thugs. I really detest that. So I don't want to like be lumped in with that way
of
thinking.
Really, but they're really not thugs.
I've met these people.
I didn't see that, and I would be honest. You know, I would be honest.
I know, but the point I'm making is that they're not thugs, but they're pissed off, and I would be too. Like, how do you prevent them from understandably reacting to this, in my view, clear goading and provocation?
I think you just have to be a bit more sensible and understand. It's a game of chess. Mm. Understand that the police have already got five moves ahead of you. Mm-hmm. Preempt those five moves. Mm. You know, they put out a tweet saying you're gonna turn up as thugs and football hooligans. Mm. Right. So what's the best thing to do?
Be on your
best behaviour.
Yeah, yeah.
You shouldn't have to be.
No, indeed.
I'm not encouraging people to be on their bad behaviour, but you know what I mean. You shouldn't have to watch your P's and Q's 100% of the time just to walk down the road. Mm. But if you know they're going to get you, don't antagonise them. Don't swear at them, don't throw beers at them, don't try and push through them. Just let them have their little,
you know, moment where they get to control things for 5 minutes and then they'll get bored.
How do you communicate that to the rank and file on the ground? So this is the thing, like, I suppose I'm not framing the question very well. I mean, what could the organisers of these protests do? Because presumably there is some kind of hierarchy going on. Because you hosted a Spaces, or Twitter Spaces the other evening, which I listened to I only managed to catch the last 10 minutes, but it was actually Tommy Robinson was the guest, if I'm not mistaken. And this came up. One of the things that was put on the table is that something about stewards. Mm. Do you want to elaborate on that?
I mean, I've never heard of this concept before. I'm just learning about it this week. But when Tommy has held marches and rallies before, he's had people on the ground to be a buffer between his supporters and the police. Mm-hmm. That way, if people get mouthy or get a little bit leery amongst his lot, then he'll control them. Mm. The stewards will control them and say, look, wind your neck in a little bit before the police get involved. So I actually think that's a good system. Because you already know the police are going to be looking for any excuse because they don't like Tommy Robinson.
Yeah.
One thing I would say about the space that I held on Twitter was that he spent 3 hours with me. And by the end of it, I got so many messages saying, before this, I thought he was a racist. Mm. Afterwards, I actually think he's a really good guy.
Mm.
Which is incredible because if you read headlines and you read newspapers, you'd think, oh, he's just a racist thug.
Mm.
But when you really get to know him, he can back up a lot of the things that he says. He's very knowledgeable. He's very intelligent. Right. They make out like he's dumb. He's not dumb.
Yeah.
He's not silly.
And you still see him being talked about that way on media outlets like GB News or right-leaning media outlets, that he is the sort of beyond the pale person that you said, it's got Tommy Robinson. So we have
GB News have got a massive problem with identity. You know, the home of free speech, yet they sack people for speaking freely. So what are you expecting when it comes to people like Tommy or Katie Hopkins or even further afield like Paul Joseph Watson? They'd never touch him, you know, but why not? Home of free speech should encourage that.
And I've never seen him say anything overtly racist. He always condemns racism, Tommy Robinson. And if he was invited onto GB News, I imagine he'd handle himself pretty well.
The thing with Tommy is that he's got a lot to say in a short period of time, because he's been silenced for the past 5 years. You know, when he got kicked off of social media for exposing the BBC for being corrupt with his Panorama documentary, he's effectively been in the underworld of social media on Getter and Telegram and places like that, where people who really want to follow him have to go and find him.
Indeed.
But now that he's got his voice back, why not give him the opportunity to say his bit?
Yeah.
The establishment have treated him very badly, as far as I'm concerned. How can you try your best to discredit somebody when they're exposing child molesters? I don't see how you can justify that.
But do you think he has a tendency? So this is a more nuanced critique than he's a thug, or I'm not even going to go anywhere near him with a 10-foot barge pole. But do you think that he's sometimes forget his him being well motivated and forget that he handles himself well? I mean, not only would he handle himself well on GB News, I've seen him handle himself brilliantly on hostile media.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen him up against, like, it's one of the most satisfying the debates you've ever seen. And like, Piers Morgan is just completely naked before
The Quran one? The Quran down.
Have some respect. Have some goddamn respect, all this sort of thing. And Tommy Robinson quoted some very, very juicy content from William Gladstone, no less, who in the 1870s was railing against Islam because of what Turkish atrocities were doing for the Bulgarians and the Balkans. And so, Gladstone was a very learned chap. I'm sure he'd read the Quran, probably read it in Arabic, and no, he probably didn't, but nevertheless, learned it. And Tommy was saying, if I'm racist according to your logic, Piers, then do you condemn William Gladstone? And then he just quoted a juicy passage from Gladstone. So he's very good at handling himself. But do you think, apart from all those virtues, which I do genuinely believe he has, and he's obviously very brave as well, do you think that he is strategically impulsive and unwise at times in a way which falls much more into the hands of his enemies than it falls into the hands of people like us?
I think maybe he used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he might agree with that assessment. But currently, I think he's doing a very good job.
Mm-hmm.
I think he understands that. I mean, you'd have to understand. You'd have to be a bit dumb not to understand at this point, when you've had so many hit pieces and so many court cases unjustly against you.
Yeah.
That, you have to fix up a little bit and maybe speak in a different way and, conduct yourself in a better way. And I think he handles himself very well.
Yeah, it's not the way he speaks. It's never the way he speaks for me. It's always behavior. And so an example, this is from his past. I'm going to go into that because we're talking about him now. But like, I'll ask you, Amy, do you agree with my general framing of this on Robinson? And do you think that, particularly, I suppose a good example, a more recent one would be the Cenotaph, like where it could have been great headlines for us, and that would have spread to normies as well, because not everyone is on Getter, not everyone is, they should be, but not everyone is consuming the content of, you know, honest citizen journalists. Most people's media diet is pretty pathetic, frankly. So do you think that on the Cenotaph, for instance, the fact that the headlines weren't British national holiday completely overshadowed by ethno-religious zealots, which parading their grievances through London, like that should have been the headline, and instead it was thugs arrested near the Cenotaph for breaking police barrier. And Robinson, like, do you think that? What's your view on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was there on that day, on a Mr. Stay, when when the men kind of were around the Cenotaph, and they weren't doing anything at all. Mm. They weren't shouting anything extremist. They were just congregating, basically, and waving the English flag. Some of them were shouting Tommy Robinson in a kind of chant. Which is allowed, but I suspect that's why they get labelled as far right. Yeah, he's just become this strange figure,
bogeyman
that represents all sorts of things. And I think coming back to your point, perhaps he has had a history of, I mean, not totally sure myself, but he has had a history of maybe being a bit violent or being a bit thuggish in the past. I don't know.
Often it seems, there were people that say, he's been, as my understanding is, he's been arrested. There's a very good, there's a really good Douglas Murray article on Tommy Robinson where he just sums it all up. It's called, it's in National, type in Douglas Murray National Review Tommy Robinson, you'll get a very good breakdown of his history. One of the things that hardly ever mentioned is that one of his assault counts was because he headbutted a neo-Nazi at one of his own rallies, which, you know, the media doesn't, oh God, Tommy Robinson headbutted someone, it's awful. And obviously the normies think, oh God, I'm sure it was some poor Pakistani gentleman. It's like, no, he wasn't a neo-Nazi, you know, who wanted to hijack some EDL event. So, like, you know, there is all this. I don't know. So I don't know how to. It's difficult to frame this properly. But
it's difficult because people like Tommy Robinson and the people that protest at the St. George's marches, they're motivated by emotion and passion and instinct. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're there. And that's why the other people aren't there.
Yeah.
And then you're sort of asking them to not be passionate or not to act on instinct, which is such a hard balance to get right, because that's why they're there in the first place, because they feel something that's deeply wrong.
Yes.
And then you're sort of saying, no, but you've got to be really logical and rational about what you're doing. It's like, but that's not what this is about. So it's very hard to try and think in terms of strategically how you would make sure, you know, all it needs is for one person to do something out of hand, and then that's the thing that's on the front page.
Exactly.
So it's really hard. It does feel like a trap in so many ways.
Yes. When you're enemies are laying a trap for you, don't walk into it, presumably. What are your views on this? Because we're talking, I think it's only fair to talk about Robinson more recently, since he's been back up on Twitter, for example. I'm like, what did you think of the whole Cenotaph affair? Do you think that he was wise to get a group of his people, and then I would never call them thugs, but to get a group of these people, like, you know, sort of, you know, sauntering on down to the Cenotaph? And it's good visuals, it looks great, but do you think it...
Well, responsibly, why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
Because you're going to get... Because what was going to happen is that it's going to overshadow the day, and it's going to become all the headlines, which most people consume. Most people don't consume our sort of content. But I'll give you an example. So Tom Tugendhat called these people thugs. He is the MP for a 93% white British constituency in Kent. Okay, he is not going to be punished by his constituents. He's going to be one of the few Tories who keeps his seat. He is not going to be punished for that, I think, atrociously snobbish remark, because most of those people, I'm sure they have sort of the people in his constituency, I'm sure they're sort of biscuit tin patriots. I'm sure they have, images of Churchill in their home. They're not sort of James O'Brien leftists, but they do probably still watch the BBC. They probably watch Sky News, these other places. They've drunk the Kool-Aid on Robinson, and so when you give these mainstream outlets an opportunity to demonize him, they will do so, and so that would be the reason why not to do that.
But it's headline grabbing. You talk about Tommy, it's a headline, it will sell the paper.
Yeah.
When it comes to the Cenotaph, the Armistice Day,
one of our friends, Lewis Brackpool, was there the other day. He did some citizen journalism, and the video that he produced of the scuffle.
It's great, yeah.
I think it was the most viral video of the day. Had millions of views, was shared by everybody.
Yes.
And, you know, people on the left and the right, I think it was even shared by Alistair Campbell, of all people.
Yeah.
Showing how the police are, you know, essentially instigating trouble. So, yeah, more reason to go. More reason to go, because I think that if you are awake, you get your news from Twitter.
I agree. I'm not disagreeing with any of this. The point is that most people are not awake. And so this is what I think is the problem with Robinson. It's not anything to do here with what he thinks, really. I mean, that I've examined. I've never really been offended by anything you said, actually, it's more to do with the strategy and the tactics that you employ in the service of that message. And I think that he is laboring under the democratic ethos of our time a bit, this idea that the people, the earthy, organic sentiments of the people, what Disraeli called the sublime instincts of an ancient people, that matters more than, you know, elites. And the fact is that Lewis Brackpool's video went very viral on Twitter, but most people wouldn't, nevertheless, and this is why Tom Tugendhat is not going to be punished, because the people of Tunbridge and whatever it's called, Tunbridge and Malling, where he's the MP, they're not consuming, though they should be, our friend Lewis Brackpool's content. They will watch Sky News in the evening for 10 minutes and they will conclude. I know someone, I have a close friend of mine whose dad, who is pretty right wing, you know, said genuinely his takeaway from the not the Cenotaph one, but the more recent one, at the St. George's Day scuffle, was that these were sort of English working class thugs who went around beating up minorities. That it was generally his sort of takeaway from what happened. And it's because he's consuming mainstream elite filtered sources. And what I'm saying is that because elites are more instrumental in the formation of public opinion than public sentiment, like organic public sentiment is, that matters, and that makes PR really important.
How do you prevent that from happening then? What's the solution to that problem? Because the only way you avoid that is by not turning up. And if you don't turn up, you've lost. You lose the culture war of being English and why these elites don't want you to be proud of being English. You don't get any of these things for St. Patrick's Day. No one says, no, you can't come out because, you know, the Irish are racist. No one ever says that.
I'm not saying that. So I think with the more recent one, it's harder. I'm talking about the Cenotaph one, when it should have just been, I would just let these termites, quite frankly, just, you know, defile and not defile, like actually, you know, knock them down or anything like that, but just let the optics just be so dreadful for the people who defend multiculturalism and diversity, rather than give the media any other reason. I'm not saying that there's no room at all for direct action, but the idea that, I don't think that marches on, you know, public monuments by well-intentioned, good, earthy working class people are going to shift the dial. I don't think that's going to win us the culture war. I think in many ways, precisely because elite sentiment is more important, regrettably, than popular sentiment, I think that it's going to, I think that's actually a bit of shooting yourself in the foot. Like, you have to be judged on a case by case basis.
It comes down to the degradation of popular talisman. So for example, you know, when Nigel Farage was the leader of UKIP, everyone associated with UKIP was racist. Funny that.
Yeah.
Because they've got an opinion which can be justified and you can objectively debate and say, well, X, Y, and Z is actually happening. Let's change that. And you pick one guy, everyone who follows that guy, which is many millions, will then be tarnished. The same with Tommy. You know, at one point he was the most followed public figure on Facebook before he got banned. He had more followers than all the politicians combined, all the political parties combined. So no wonder they got rid of him. Because he was influential against what they wanted to do, which is to make everything multicultural and feminized and gay. And I've got nothing against any of those things, you know, that's fine. But it doesn't need to be shoved down our throats 24/7. No, it does not. And when you get people standing up against that, the system goes, well done. We've made our minds up. We want everything to be about LGBT and Muslims and immigration and net zero and all the other stuff that I can't stand.
But even what you're saying there, and of course I agree with it on like the merit of what you're saying, completely I agree. And so anyone accusing me of being a pansy in the comments is wrong. I'm not a pansy. I want to be successful. I want to win. And I don't think that, like, take case by case basis. I'm not going to like give some general rule for how to be an activist or anything like that. But I just think you need to be prudent. And you, in your remarks there, there's an implicit concession that you said, like, they, that's why they took him down. Like, well, who is they? They is the elites. Like, these are the people who really do dictate things. And so my view would be that rather than romanticizing, which it's understandable, but rather than romanticizing like the demos, so to speak, and in many ways it's quite a just thing to do as well. I met some of these people. I like them a great deal. I think they possess a kind of earthly wisdom which our elites lack, because they're so obsessed with these sort of abstract theories of the good. And I'd much rather spend time with these chaps than I would with James O'Brien. But nevertheless, I still think that we are underestimating the extent to which elites mobilize sentiment in the country. And I would just be in favor of being a little bit more strategic on things, case by case basis, of course. But do you not agree with that? Or do you think that I
do, but I think it's a bit of a, you know, you might as well give up then. That's the kind of attitude that I think you're trying to put across there, because you can't beat the elites. I mean, the enemy here is really the BBC. It starts from there.
Yeah.
You know, Tommy's downfall started with them because he exposed them.
Yes.
And then everyone else just followed suit. So who controls the BBC in reality?
Yes.
Is it the Director General of the BBC, or is it the government?
Yeah. No, I'm definitely not saying give up. That's not my view at all. I just don't... It's difficult to frame it because I want to make it... I don't want to be too general, because I don't think there's like a general rule here. I've tried to say that, but this is not a council of despair. This is what we should be trying to do, is we should be trying to know when it's actually helps us win, not giving up, but we know, like the Napoleon comment, like, don't interrupt your enemy while he's making a mistake.
It's difficult though, because the BBC will always, or the mainstream media will always give their own spin on anything. So in your example, like if you'd allowed the pro-Palestinian marches to just totally take over the Cenotaph on a Mr's Day, it may well have been presented as a sort of victory for the pro-Palestinian movement, like, aren't they courageous? Aren't they, you know, they're standing up for their beliefs or whatever. And it's very hard to... You know, and I think what it would have done, if you'd allowed that to happen, is that the honest, decent people that think like us or are concerned about it would just feel more frightened and be more demoralised and just think, well, we better keep quiet because they really have got power. So it's so hard. Whatever you do, there will always be a mainstream media spin on the thing.
Absolutely.
And those people that maybe aren't on Twitter all the time, maybe have concerns, but I'm still watching the BBC, they're going to take that interpretation, whatever. So it's... I do think it is just, hopefully, I'm hoping that more people will get on Twitter, basically.
Yes.
Because I do think these conversations are happening more and more. Well, I've noticed people, like I've had people contact me, like nurses that I used to work with, who I didn't know about their politics, but they've seen what I'm doing and they're saying, yeah, I'm becoming concerned. And more kind of, I don't know, like normie people are sort of, all it takes is one or two things for them to start questioning things. And they look at people on Twitter or on social media, and then and that's it. That gets the ball rolling. So I just maybe it is just that bridge needs to happen more often.
I completely agree. But so the only point I'm making is that there are times when, in the interest of winning, not in the interest of bending over, in the interest of winning, it's actually better to be still for a second and be strategic and be forward thinking and wise, because if you are purely act on noble impulse, sometimes your impulses will serve you correctly. Intuitions is often a very good guide to conduct. Often it's not. Often it's you do it a bit more meditation before you do it. And when you act in ways which give those normies an excuse to keep their head in the sand rather than really to smell the coffee. And the elites will obviously want them to keep their heads in the sand rather than smell the coffee. I just think that there are times when, in the interests of winning, we actually need to sit still for a moment. And like, for example, that's why I gave the example of these governors in... I think this is a brilliant opportunity, not to do nothing necessarily in every instance, but these Republican governors should be just letting this chaos, not actual violent chaos, but just letting these images... like go all around the media, the civil war within the left, between the elite left, which tends to be more pro-Israel, and the kind of orcs on the ground, which tend to be, you know, more pro-Palestine. Let that civil war just light up, protect actual threats of violence and intimidation, and, you know, maintain law and order. And if people are illegally encamping, then yeah, quietly take them away. But I just think the right is sometimes it's too noble and impulsive for its own good.
Perhaps you're right. I mean, I don't know what the strategy would be moving forward, but I do take on board what you're saying, and I think that there needs to be a lot more deeper thought in how to get the message across without coming across as how the media will portray you.
Exactly.
But I've got no idea how to do that.
What do you think the prospects of citizen journalism are over the next, like, how important is it going to be over the next 5 years? We've likely got a Labour government coming up. It's probably going to become more important than ever.
Well, I have a quite negative prediction with Labour. I think they're going to prohibit free speech. I think that'll be one of the first things that they do. They'll make it somewhat impossible, if not illegal, to criticise transgenderism, immigration, race relations, all the things that we are concerned about in culture today. So I think that citizen journalism will be very important for as long as it's allowed to go on.
Yeah.
And I do worry that they might take that away. I might be a little bit too extreme in my prediction there, but I think that it's very possible, well, along with 16-year-olds getting the vote and a rejoining of the EU.
It sounds like we'll all have to hang together almost assuredly. We will all hang separately. Charlie Sansom, thank you so much for coming on to Deprogram. It's been a real privilege. Amy, thank you for stepping in as co-host again. You've been watching Deprogrammed. Make sure to like, subscribe, leave a comment if you wish, and we shall see you on the next one.
Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.